Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present University of Michigan research scientist Susan Wright, who takes a critical look at the Bush administration's justification for launching a war against Iraq. Ralph Nader, who discusses his opposition to a U.S. attack on Baghdad and his assessment of the growing international peace movement. And Lawrence Michel of the Economic Policy Institute, who explains why 10 Nobel laureates, supported by more than 450 economists, have publicly condemned the Bush administration's proposed tax cuts. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
While U.S. Secretary of State Colin Powell accuses Iraq of hiding chemical and biological agents, the Pentagon is working to create its own so-called incapacitating weapons that use fentanyl, the opiate used by the Russian army during last fall's Moscow theater siege that killed 117 people. But the use of non-lethal calmatives in combat situations, according to The Nation magazine, violates existing chemical weapons treaties. The long-held fear is that a country, once struck by these compound agents, would respond with a full-scale assault of more deadly chemical and biological weapons. In 1972, a provision was included in the Biological and Toxic Weapons Convention to stop the spread of biological and chemical weapons. But last year, the Bush administration opposed a draft agreement to strengthen inspections under the convention. The Pentagon's interest in incapacitating agents goes back to the 1993 debacle in Somalia, when U.S. troops died in fierce street battles with paramilitary forces in Mogadishu. In the mid-90s, the Pentagon set up a directorate on the use of non-lethal weapons that looked at the aggressive use of divergent psychoactive drugs like Prozac, Valium, and Zoloft against enemy soldiers in combat. Now, some military analysts are advocating the use of non-lethal agents in any future urban assault on Baghdad as a way to minimize the number of American casualties in house-to-house combat. Dissenting scientists object to this aggressive use of new bioweapons. As Professor Barbara Hatch Rosenberg, chair of the American Federation of Scientists Working Group on Bioweapons, warned, "We are encouraging a biological arms race. The doctrine of preemption has replaced the doctrine of arms control." In his State of the Union address, President George W. Bush was quick to credit the U.S. for having liberated women in Afghanistan. He said, quote, "The last time we met in this chamber, the mothers and daughters of Afghanistan were captives in their own homes, forbidden from working or going to school. Today," he continued, "women are free and are part of Afghanistan's new government. However, according to a 52-page report by Human Rights Watch, nothing could be further from the truth. Afghan women and girls living in the western region of Herat under a local governor named Ismail Khan are subjected to harsh restrictions, often forbidden from working, frequently interrogated, forced to wear burqas, and subjected to forced chastity tests." Zama Khorzin Neff, co-author of the report and researcher with the Children's Rights Division of Human Rights Watch, says, quote, "Women and girls are still being abused, harassed, and threatened throughout Afghanistan, often by government troops and officials. Under the Herat government, which receives military and financial aid from the United States, women's groups have been censored and pushed out of politics. That government has even recruited schoolboys to spy on girls and women to report back what they charge as un-Islamic behavior. Police frequently question women and girls seen alone with men, even taxi drivers, after which women are brought to hospitals and subjected to medical examinations to determine whether they've had sexual intercourse, or, if unmarried, whether they are virgins. In light of their findings, Human Rights Watch has asked international donors to cease aid to local commanders and warlords and to direct assistance through the Afghan Transitional Administration in Kabul. The group is calling for expanded human rights monitoring to protect the rights of women and girls in Afghanistan." In the weeks leading up to Valentine's Day, millions of roses are quickly transported through the steamy greenhouses in Cayambe Valley in Ecuador. Women sort pristine roses into bunches of 25, which are then wrapped, boxed, and chilled for shipment to Miami for sale to American sweethearts. But prior to being exported, Ecuadorian roses are sprayed with pesticides to kill insects and mildew, and preservatives to keep the flowers fresh while waiting to clear U.S. customs. A rose that costs less than 17 cents to harvest in Ecuador sells for $8 in the United States. According to Mother Jones magazine, recent studies by the International Labor Organization and Ecuador's Catholic University show that 60% of all post-harvest rose workers complain of symptoms of pesticide poisoning, such as headaches, blurred vision, and muscular twitching. Women, who comprise 70% of rose workers, experience a high rate of miscarriages, and children under the age of 18, who make up 20% of the rose workforce, suffer from high rates of neurological damage. European consumers are now demanding a green label on roses to assure that flowers imported from Ecuador meet basic labor and environmental standards. However, U.S. rose importers are resisting any new regulations requiring improved conditions. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon and Britta Brundage. For Between the Lines, I'm Sasha Summer Cousineau.
Secretary of State Colin Powell's presentation of the Bush administration's case justifying their drive for war against Iraq before the UN Security Council February 5th met with mixed reviews. The former U.S. Army general presented satellite photos, monitored communications, and uncorroborated accusations to convince the world that Saddam Hussein is in league with al-Qaeda and continues to conceal and build weapons of mass destruction. While the U.S. media offered little in the way of critical analysis as to the facts presented by Mr. Powell, the European press expressed serious skepticism. In his speech, Powell cited, quote, a fine paper distributed by British intelligence, of which substantial portions embarrassingly turned out to have been the plagiarized work of a California graduate student. But even as the White House put its public relations machine in overdrive to win public support for a war with Baghdad, President Bush faced a rebellion among powerful U.S. allies in Europe. France, Germany, and Russia criticized Washington's intention to attack Iraq and advocated more time for intensified U.N. weapons inspections. The Bush agenda for war has also sparked discord within NATO, where a request from Turkey for military defense assistance in the event of a future war with Iraq was blocked by France, Germany, and Belgium. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Susan Wright, a research scientist at the University of Michigan and co-author of Biological Warfare and Disarmament, New Problems, New Perspectives. Wright takes a critical look at the Bush administration's justification for launching war against Iraq and the gathering international opposition to Washington's approach to disarmament.
Clearly, the French and the Germans don't agree at all with the Bush administration, are very opposed to the concept, I think, of preemptive war. And so I think it's a struggle between the assault on the existing legal order established by the UN, by the Bush administration, and an attempt to defend that order in a way. I think it's a very important moment. And the countries that were involved in World War II, I think, are far more sensitive to the impacts of wars, apparently, than the Bush administration is. By this point, you know, after many years of an embargo and also the disarmament effort under Resolution 687, which came to an end in 1998, nevertheless was pursued for many years. At the end of all of that, Iraq is, you know, a defeated, impoverished country. It doesn't have much. We know it doesn't have nuclear weapons. It may have hidden some chemical and biological weapons, but we don't know that yet anyway. But we know it doesn't have much. It's not a serious threat, unlike North Korea, which could do some real damage. And so I think the lesson that other states might take away from all of this is that nuclear weapons are actually a very good defense, and that perhaps inadvertently, the Bush administration is actually encouraging the proliferation of nuclear weapons all over the world because countries see what is happening to Iraq and realize that if they have them, they're less likely to be attacked. That's a kind of erosion and unraveling of world order, I think.
How would you assess Secretary of State Colin Powell's delivery of the quote-unquote evidence of Iraq's duplicitous dealing with the UN weapons inspectors, deception and concealment, which include satellite photos, monitored communications, and so forth? You want to summarize your thoughts on that for us?
What I think that Powell did was to deliver the case for the prosecution. He made it the evidence appear to be as damning as possible. But basically, when he said, you know, there were 16,000 liters of anthrax unaccounted for, oh, well, they're unaccounted for. We don't know whether they exist or not. It remains to be seen. He said that Iraq has mobile biological facilities. Possibly, yes, but is there anything in them? We don't know that either. He said that Iraq had hidden some 30 chemical weapons. Well, that's interesting because not very many compared to the hundreds and thousands that the U.S. still must destroy under the Chemical Weapons Convention. And then there was the key point, I think, that the Bush administration relies on, that Iraq has some kind of relationship with an al-Qaeda group. But that's really the most tenuous of relationships, at least the CIA seemed to believe so earlier on. So, you know, I think all of these claims need to be tested. We've only heard one side. So I agree with France, Germany, and the other countries that are questioning the Bush administration's position that it's very important to allow the inspectors to do their work. And I think eventually for it to be terminated, that this is not a case for war. That seems to be what a majority of people all over the world are saying.
Would you summarize for us some of your research into more constructive ways to go about disarmament rather than aggressive threats? Are there other models of disarmament that are more effective than threatening warfare? And what kinds of methods and tactics do you think the world community could use to better affect disarmament in Iraq?
I think that it's not possible to treat one country at a time in the Middle East. And I think I'm going back to early approaches to the Middle East, which after all is this crucible of conflict with many interests in weapons of mass destruction, not only in the part of Iraq, but other countries too. When you have a situation in a region where there are nuclear weapons, I think there are bound to be, and of course Israel has an arsenal of nuclear weapons, there are bound to be interest on the part of other regional powers, if only for deterrence purposes, if only for the kind of situation that the United States and the former Soviet Union were in for so long during the Cold War. So the Middle East has to be, I think, in the long run, treated as a system. But then you say, well, could one go for a comprehensive weapons of mass destruction free zone? And that was tried to an extent, at least it was explored, during the regional talks of the early 1990s, and it went nowhere for many different reasons. But one reason was clearly that there was a need to solve Israel's territorial struggles before anything else could be resolved. And the other reason, I think, is that there was a need for recognition both of Israel and of the Palestinian state. But until those conditions are satisfied, I think countries in the Middle East are going to see reasons for playing the same game that the U.S. and the USSR played, a game of deterrence or uncertainty about what they possess and what they don't possess.
That was University of Michigan research scientist Susan Wright, co-author of Biological Warfare and Disarmament, New Problems, New Perspectives, published by Roman and Littlefield. Consumer advocate and former Green Party presidential candidate Ralph Nader is wearing an additional hat these days as an anti-war activist. He held a news conference in Washington, D.C. last week with other groups opposed to war in Iraq, where he accused the Bush administration of allowing its ties to the oil industry to lead the country to battle, and was quoted as saying the administration is marinated in oil. Nader criticized Bush for refusing to meet with retired military officers, former intelligence agents, academics, clergy, and business leaders who support pursuing a diplomatic resolution to the Iraq crisis. Nader spoke at a fundraiser for the New Haven Green Party in his home state of Connecticut, February 8th, where he again emphasized the number of top retired military officials who oppose the war, but he said Bush isn't listening. He urged Americans to continue to speak out against the war and describe the terrible consequences likely to ensue from a full-scale U.S. attack on Iraq. Between the lines, Melinda Tuhu spoke with Ralph Nader about his views on the White House drive for war and the growing international peace movement.
It's like a beehive. If you're standing near a beehive, You can watch it operate, but if you smack it hard, the bees are going to come out. And just as the CIA predicted last year in a letter to Congress, that if we invade Iraq and attack Saddam Hussein, he's very likely to use, or more likely to use, chemical and biological weapons, the raw materials of which we sold him under the Reagan and Bush administration under Department of Commerce export license. I mean, this is an incredible situation that we now are condemning this brutal dictator for doing in the 1980s what he did with chemical warfare based on materials we sold him before, during, and after he gassed these innocent people and the Iranian combatants.
You've been in Washington many decades. You've been through a lot of administrations. How does this administration stack up compared to, say, what went on during the Nixon administration or the Reagan administration in terms of, well, I guess a whole range of things you'd like to comment on, civil rights, civil liberties certainly, but also our willingness to go it alone in the world?
This is the most radical, extremist administration. George W. Bush is not his father's son. In fact, his father was counseling through his older security advisors to go very careful on this Iraq situation. And in the process, the Bush administration is transforming America for the worst. They're starving the necessities of our country in terms of budgets that are now being allocated to the war against Iraq and the military buildup. They are undermining our civil liberties, the critical pillar of our democracy, chilling political dissent and privacy, and creating a nation of suspects. And above all, they're endangering this country by a reckless invasion of Iraq that many retired generals and admirals think pose no threat to the United States, however brutal he is to his own people.
You talked earlier about Americans should look at different sources and inform themselves, but since the vast majority of Americans aren't doing that, do you have any hope or any idea how the tide might be turned? I mean, there is a lot of anti-war sentiment, and there's been huge demonstrations, but what else has to happen for more people to become aware of the things that you've spoken about?
Well, Americans are fair-minded people. If they think that the President of the United States has never received an anti-war delegation, whether from the clergy, human rights, military, veterans, business, even some Republicans who are against this war, then they'll look at President Bush as a president who doesn't want to listen. And people don't like presidents who don't want to listen, who just go on TV and with belligerent sound bites talk to the American people. I think that has to become a near-term issue. This president is not hearing the other side from many people who have fought in our wars and who know and are much more experienced about these matters than both he and his chicken hawk advisors.
I heard you mention earlier that Al Gore has probably been the Democrat who's spoken out most strongly against what's currently going on. Do you think he can only do that because he's not either in elected office or running for president again?
Well, that's certainly part of it. Al Gore outside of office is different than Al Gore in office. He's freer to be who he is instead of to be a prisoner of the various lobbies that surround a White House and are very warmongering.
Last time you were here, you were talking a lot about your new organization at the time called Democracy Rising. Has that been folded into United for Justice and Peace? I mean, is that a member organization of it, or how much of a role is that organization playing in educating the American people or trying to reach out to people with views that might be different from the mainstream?
Oh, it's part of the anti-war coalition, and lots of people are working in different dimensions of this struggle.
What do you think will happen if and when we go into a full-fledged war? Do you think that the American population will go more toward supporting the president because we're in a full-scale war, or do you think there'll be even more obvious and widespread opposition, or both?
Unfortunately, the minute the first shots or bombs are fired or fall, most people give up any opposition to the president, and he will have overwhelming support, whether active or passive, with the exception of some hardcore dissenters who think that if wars can't be stopped, they can be shortened and they can be minimized in terms of their damage.
And what do you think those hardcore dissenters should do?
Keep up the opposition. You know, if stopping the war is important, if the war starts, it's even more important to stop the war. I mean, this isn't a war where there is any firepower on the other side, so to speak. They don't have an air force, they don't have a navy, their military is obsolete. The only danger comes from chemical and biological material release. The American people who are not participating in this great debate on the war should realize that if they don't have a say, they're very likely to pay, and in many ways, for themselves and their children, in terms of the state of the economy and the safety of our country.
That was former Green Party presidential candidate and citizen activist Ralph Nader. His latest book is titled Crashing the Party, published by St. Martin's Press. Contact organizations affiliated with Nader by visiting his Essential Information website at www.essential.org. Nobel laureates, supported by more than 450 economists from across the country, have publicly condemned the Bush administration's tax cut plan. At a February 10th press conference in the nation's capital, these economists warned that congressional passage of the $674 billion in tax cuts over the next 10 years advocated by President Bush will bring about fiscal deterioration that will reduce the capacity of the government to finance Social Security and Medicare benefits, as well as investments in schools, health, infrastructure, and basic research. Moreover, they say, the proposed tax cuts will generate further inequalities in after-tax income. The economists, who gathered hundreds of signatures for their statement in only 1 week, pointed out in a full-page ad in the New York Times February 11th that the dividend tax cut and other features of the White House proposal will constitute a permanent change in the tax structure and not the creation of jobs and growth in the near term. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Lawrence Michel, president of the Economic Policy Institute, the group which coordinated the joint statement. Michel explains why so many influential economists have come out to denounce the president's tax cut plan as the wrong approach.
We had 10 Nobel laureates sign the statement which opposed the Bush tax cuts, and I'm not familiar with any other statement ever put together that had that many signatories from Nobel laureates in economics. Well, I think there's wide agreement among economists generally, and definitely among the group represented at the press conference. We're having a sluggish recovery. The economy is expanding, but it's expanding too slowly to be able to create jobs, and that's a problem. The question is then what to do about it. And I think many economists believe that the actual plan that President Bush has proposed, and specifically the idea of not taxing dividends, is really a very misdirected way to approach a stimulus. It's not effective as a stimulus in the short run, and in fact, most of the Nobelists, in fact, all of them that spoke, suggested that that plan may actually decrease investment and lower job growth in the long run. The dividend exclusion itself is not powerful, but the policy is also associated with very large chronic deficits way into the future, which whatever positive effect you might get from a tax cut is outweighed by the fact that we have deficits which lower national savings, raise interest rates, and lower investment. So President Bush has picked an item, a dividend tax exclusion, which is almost the least stimulative thing you could imagine someone picking, according to these economists. Professor McFadden from University of California, Berkeley, in fact, called it anti-stimulatory and said it was like a weapon of mass destruction aimed at the middle class, which I take to be very strong words for an academic to speak, but that just shows the depth of the feeling there.
The Nobel laureates and the hundreds of economists who signed on to this statement expressed concern about Social Security, Medicare, health and education, as well as the social safety net for the poorest in this country. You want to expand on that?
One of the main reasons for this tax cut, in our view, is that the idea is to bankrupt government, to take away the possibility of even maintaining the kind of domestic spending we have now, let alone to increase it appropriately into the future, so that it'll make it very hard to deal with the problems of Social Security and Medicare, education, infrastructure, R&D spending. It's really about squeezing domestic spending, anything but the defense budget and what the government has to spend anyway. So, that's one of the very conscious purposes of this series of large tax cuts. We had one passed in 2001. There's one now being proposed, obviously, for $674 billion. The budget actually has another large tax cut in the form of forgiving all taxes on income received from capital gains and interest and such that if people have in certain new savings accounts. So there's just an endless ideas for how to cut taxes with no corresponding idea about how to meet our needs as a country.
The Nobel laureates who spoke at the press conference, how did they address the issue of income inequality in this country, which for a time stalled and turned around a little bit during the expansion of the 1990s, but again, with hard times, we're looking at greater inequality in this country, among the worst records of industrialized nations in the world, if I'm not incorrect.
Well, no, I think you're absolutely correct. The United States in the late 1970s would have been considered the country with the most unequal incomes of any of the advanced countries. But over the last 25 years, we've seen inequality grow tremendously more, so that we hands down win the prize for the most unequal country, and it's the most where we have the greatest inequality in our modern history at this point in time, and the greatest among countries. So we're definitely a leader in income inequality. I think one of the problems with the Bush tax plan is that, first and foremost, it is not effective at creating jobs in the short run or the long run. And in so doing, it actually exacerbates the problems of inequality. You know, the dividend tax cut, for instance, won't benefit hardly anybody but the very best off. Well, first of all, you know only 50% of the households own any stock whatsoever and might receive dividends. And most of the dividends received by the middle-class families, those who have stock, are actually in their IRAs or their 401ks or pension plans, and so they're already are not taxed. So, you know, 50% of the benefits of the dividend tax exclusion goes to the upper 1%, and some 94% of the benefits go to the upper 20%. So clearly something that Franco Modigliani, a very feisty 85-year-old Nobel laureate from MIT who came down, said, you know, the only reason for doing this is if you want to enrich the rich and actually the richest of the rich. Listen, we had a very large tax cut in 2001 that they said was going to lead to a lot of economic growth, was just the medicine the economy needed, but we've had a very tepid recovery. So we've already tried that trick once, and it didn't work. You know, basically throwing money at rich people is not a good way to get the economy moving.
That was Lawrence Michel, president of the Economic Policy Institute, the group which coordinated the statement of 10 Nobel laureates and 450 economists condemning the Bush tax cut plan. Contact the Institute by calling area code 202-775-8810 or visit their website at www.epinet.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, or would like a recording of this week's program, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. You can also visit our website at www.btlonline.org. Our theme music was written and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Britta Brundage, Sasha Summer-Cousineau, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.